All right, we have free speech on this show. He just spewed. All right, there we go.
Yep.
First off, let's introduce our guest here, Sean Stevens from FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. And Sean, first off, let's say good morning. Thanks for joining us again today.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Now, we're going to discuss some things that I actually started talking about last week when you folks sent out a release. And probably as we're chatting here, I'm going to be saying things like, please tell me this isn't true. And probably top of the list is, Sean, please tell me you're not a New York Giants fan, are you?
Oh, poor
Sean. No, unfortunately, I am.
Oh, my goodness.
It's been a rough decade.
FIRE is in Philadelphia, is where you're based. Should I assume you're celebrating after last night's game?
Well, I'm happy that the Eagles lost. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
doesn't do the Giants much good.
Yeah, I was going to say your boys aren't going. G-men aren't going anywhere again this year. Yikes. Anyway, all right. Enough of that stuff. We've had you on before, regular listeners. You might recognize Sean's name and face. Or voice, I should say. This is radio, that's right. And again, you folks sent out something last week, and as soon as I read the opening line, I thought, oh my Lord, you got to be kidding me. So before we get to that, let's back up a little bit. Maybe we have some new listeners, or they have not heard you before, Sean. If you would, tell us something about yourself, and then tell us something about FIRE. What is FIRE, and what do you do?
Yeah, so I'm FIRE's chief research advisor. My background is in social and political psychology. I got my PhD from Rutgers in 2013. I've been with FIRE since 2020. I was brought on to largely lead the College Free Speech Rankings Project, but we've massively expanded our research department over the last 6 years, and we do a lot of other things now. FIRE itself was originally founded as the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. The way I would describe that is we were essentially the old school ACLU, but limited to college and university campuses, so we were defending student and faculty speech rights. And then in 2022, we expanded these efforts to defend the speech rights of all Americans. So that's when we rebranded as the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. And our motto is simple, if the speech is protected, we'll defend it, no questions asked.
Yeah, I'm on your email list, and you folks have, how do I phrase this, you've gotten yourselves into trouble a number of times this year because, now, to detail this, you've had instances where you backed up the free speech rights of, say, somebody on the political right, and then you catch flack for it. And then later on, you had a situation where you backed up the free speech rights on somebody on the political left, and then you caught flack for it. Talk about some of that, because you're like an equal opportunity offender. I mean, what are you folks?
Well, yeah, we're a nonpartisan organization, so like I said, if the speech is protected, we'll defend it. Our president, Greg Lukianoff, has said multiple times and even written at least one op-ed piece on his Substack about this, where it's, we'll drive this bus into the wall before we compromise those principles. So, yes, we know we sometimes defend people on, we offend people on all sides of the spectrum because we're going to defend speech on all sides of the political spectrum.
Sean, has it always been this way? People just sniping back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
To an extent, I would say yes, but I think our current media environment, social media, internet, the connectivity of everybody has amplified and made it very clear that this is the case. I don't think people trying to censor other people's views or you know, trying to curb expression is a new thing. We see it in polling data going back decades. But I do think in today's environment, we're far more aware of it, and we see it a lot more.
I'm trying to think. This was weeks and weeks ago. You folks put some kind of blurb or something. I mean, have you actually lost? I mean, you're a nonprofit, so you're looking for people to contribute and all that sort of thing. Have you lost contributors simply because you defended a certain side's speech rights? Or did I misread that?
So it's like probably a little more complicated, and you know the development team here at Fire is probably the better people to ask about this. So I'm kind of going on what I know. Yeah, I mean, we lose donors when people don't like a cause that we defend, but it seems like oftentimes just as many are lost or then new ones are gained through defending that cause that the old ones didn't necessarily like. So it does happen, but our practice of defending speech on all sides of the aisle, I think, lends itself to new donors showing up all the time.
All right. You are truly nonpartisan, which, I don't know, Sean, I think that makes you folks a rarity. I hear people kind of mouth, oh, we're nonpartisan, and then they really aren't. You guys really are.
We try our best, yeah. We do. We actually have a very politically diverse staff, I would say, too, which I think is important to basically, you know, having people in the organization be principled like that. You need to be exposed to those different views and you know, see people of all stripes.
All right. So do you folks ever have arguments when you get together for meetings?
It can get passionate, sure. We're not shy about disagreeing here, you know, so.
Okay, all right. Well, let's talk about what you folks released last week. Because, again, when I first saw this, this is last Wednesday, I just thought, oh, man, this is not good. So, first off, I mean, give us some background on what was released last week. Where did you come up with this information? I mean, I'll let you describe it, all right? What did you folks cut loose last week?
Yeah, so I'm sure most of, if not all of your listeners, are well aware of what occurred at Utah Valley University in September, where Charlie Kirk was assassinated. That actually was the day after we released our annual College Free Speech Rankings, which for the first time this year included Utah Valley. So in the aftermath of this, we thought it would be a good idea to see what students thought and how they were feeling after that incident. So we worked with our survey partner, College Pulse, who we do the rankings with. We put out a poll in early October, so it was in the field for the month of October, basically. We got a little over 2,000 undergrads surveyed. It included an oversample of about a little over 200 students at Utah Valley. The survey included a series of questions that are on the ranking survey, so we could do a pre-post comparison to the data we collected back in the spring. And then we had additional questions that we didn't ask of in the ranking survey in the spring that were more specific to the event itself. And I'll leave it at that. There's a number of juicy findings in there, but I'm sure you got questions about those. But broadly, that's what we did, and that's what we put out.
All right. Now, before we get to the findings, I'll be honest, Sean, Scott here. I'm always a little skeptical when I hear about surveys because I'm thinking, okay, what mm-hmm. was the sample size? What was the breakdown of the sample, you know, male, female, you know, skin color or something, part of the country and so on. And then you take these results and you try to, you know, say everybody. I'm always a little skeptical on that, Sean. Mm-hmm. When I was in college a very long time ago, I took a one semester course in statistics and it was enlightening. And when I came out of that course, I just thought...
I think it should be required for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. It really should be. Because I thought I had no idea about a lot of this stuff. And so some surveys that are floating around, I'm thinking, I'm not buying this one. So yours, I mean, how do we know mm-hmm. that this is, in a word, accurate?
So we, you know, our survey partner, College Pulse, has the largest... panel of undergraduates in the country. They have over a million students enrolled in it in all 50 states. What we do when we do the analyses is we apply post-stratification weighting. That sounds like a real fancy term, but effectively it's standard practice in survey research, and it's researchers acknowledging that, hey, you know, yes, we collected a sample. The sample itself may not break down as fully representative But these weights that you apply effectively create a representative sample. So if you undersampled males, you apply a weight that then increases their status in the pool basically to where it would be. It creates a representative sample of undergraduates based on information schools have provided to the Department of Education. It's maintained in what's called the IPEDS database. So we're weighting by gender, race, region of the country, socioeconomic status, things like that. Politics doesn't factor into this, so that's one thing that doesn't necessarily get weighted. But we do that. It's standard practice in survey research. All surveys have a margin of error. This one has a margin of error of about 2%, plus or minus 2%. So you can kind of, if you see, you know, a result that says 91% of students say that at least the phrase "words can be violent" at least slightly describes their thoughts. The margin of error applied to that means that could be 93% or it could be 89%, but that's the range.
All right, now that's all right. We want to go over some of the numbers from this gig, but that's what you have at the top of your release. 91% of undergraduate students believe that words can be violence. And Sean, as soon as I saw that, I'm thinking, oh my God, seriously, that's what they believe? Now, even if that's 89%, that's I'm shocked.
Very high. It's very high.
I mean, what reaction did you folks have? I can't believe that number.
Yeah, so I mean, it's troubling. I'll further clarify it to say, you know, there's five response options on that. So the 91% comes from summing up every response option that isn't, this does not describe my thoughts at all. However, about 50% of them said that phrase either mostly or completely describes their thoughts. So I do find it very troubling. It's an idea that's emerged on campus, I'd say over the last 10 to 15 years. It's kind of motivated, I think, by a drive to censor views that are disliked. If you can equate words with violence, well, then of course it makes sense to regulate these violent actions. And it's increasingly used, I think, to quash debate on campus. And then I'll add, actually, even more concerning, and this wasn't necessarily highlighted in the release, but we also asked a similar question. What do you think of the phrase, silence is violence? 79% of students said that at least slightly describes their thoughts. So basically not saying anything in the face of, something offensive being done, it can also be considered violence by a lot of students.
Okay. Now, this is hard to believe. I'll do a follow-up in a moment. But in your release, you had some other kind of breaking the numbers down a little further between maybe like so-called conservative students, moderate students, liberal students. Go into some of those numbers that you folks discovered as part of this study.
Yeah, some patterns we found were very similar across the spectrum. All students, regardless of their ideology, they're compared to the spring, there's far more students now saying violence is never acceptable to stop a speech. Within that, there are some differences. While all students kind of moved in that direction, moderate and conservative students more strongly moved that way. Conservative students are now almost at a ceiling, basically saying that violence is not acceptable to stop a speech, like well over 90%. So I think that's encouraging. Other things that we saw, though, and particularly at Utah Valley, there's some more interesting findings in that when we ask about controversial speakers and whether they should be allowed on campus, liberal students at Utah Valley became less tolerant of all six we ask about. And that includes three of them that basically have very, like, kind of left-wing political views that you would presume they agree with. So this is a little speculative, but I'm taking that as they're just concerned in general about events on campus now. somewhat of a maybe rational reaction, given that Utah Valley was the epicenter and where the assassination occurred. But that to me is very striking, in that you've got left-leaning students now being less tolerant of allowing even controversial leftist speakers to speak on campus.
Jeez. So the thought is, from these kids, there just shouldn't be any speech on campus. We shouldn't do anything. Shouldn't talk about anything.
I don't know if that's necessarily how they feel, but I think they're very, there's a lot of nervousness, a lot of anxiety. Some of this is rational. I think if you were present or you were on the campus where this assassination occurred, I could see some of this being rational. But yeah, I mean, a lot of it is a bit more concerning. I think at the end of the day, it's clear from our results that a chilling effect has occurred on campus speech across the country as a result of the assassination.
All right. Mr. Ironhead, go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple of things, Sean, real quick. Do they get into specifics as to how they are defining violent speech, which again is just ridiculous to me, because for a long time I have had problems with both hate crimes. Again, to me, a crime is a crime. If you punch me in the face, you ought not be allowed to do that. I don't feel any better if, well, at least he didn't do it because I'm a blue-eyed moron. I don't care what the reason is. Don't punch me in the face. But it's the same thing. But I'm wondering if hate speech is what they are defining as violence. If they're getting more specific on what it is that's violent, or what qualifies as violent speech, because again, the hate speech stuff just drives me crazy because of the way it can be and is defined in some cases, where it's like, well, that's not hate speech. That's just speech that you disagree with. It's not hateful. It's just different than your viewpoint.
Yeah, so we actually asked as a follow-up, so this wasn't asked of all students. It was only asked of students who said that violence was acceptable to stop a speech to some degree. So they said always, sometimes, or rarely acceptable. We basically asked them, what forms of violence do you consider acceptable to stop a speech? The most common responses here are throwing projectiles, use of chemical irritants, physically assaulting the speaker. I will note, though, that almost half of students said none of the above to the options. So I think this is telling in that most of them probably wouldn't commit violence themselves, and they certainly weren't thinking assassination as part of it. But it's still concerning that, you know, large percentages of students are like, well, yeah, like maybe once in a while this would be acceptable. Something we haven't looked at and we could maybe follow up with in a little bit, we actually asked students on this survey an open-ended question of simply, how do you define hate speech? That's qualitative analysis, so we haven't kind of crunched that yet in the effort to kind of get these top-line results out. So I don't have really any juicy quotes from there for you right now, but we did ask that, and I could probably come back and talk about that at a later date.
I would just be curious because, again, there are things, and I would still defend the right of people to say it. Again, that's the whole thing with free speech, which somehow we've just lost, is, yeah, I'm all for free speech as long as you say something that I agree with. But if you start down a road where I passionately disagree with, then, there can be consequences for free speech. Like, that's the other, you know, to go to the other extreme, it's like, well, no, I can say whatever I want and there should be, you know, nothing anybody can do about it. Well, no, that is also not true. If you are out there representing a company or, you know, a organization and you say something that is clearly going to be detrimental to the company or the organization, by all means, they have the right to, all right, we're going to distance ourselves from you, bye-bye. Nobody is saying that. It's the, you know, government and, like, criminal ramifications. And I'll tell you, we're starting to see some scary things happening over in Europe and the UK right now in that regard, where there are real consequences here for having, or not having freedom of speech. Like jail results.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to start becoming like some of our European brethren across the ocean. You know, Britain, Germany have some very interesting speech laws over there, and we definitely, I would say, we don't want to move in that direction. But yeah, I mean, this year we've seen a lot. We've seen a lot of things shift in terms of campus speech. There is still the threat that's been present for at least the past decade from students and smaller portion of faculty that identify on the political left. But we're now seeing far more government action attempting to target campus speech from the state and federal government. And it's concerning, and the large uptick in it, we maintain these couple databases on our site as part of our research as well. We have the platforming database, which tracks attempts to get speakers canceled, get art exhibits removed, things like that, play performances stopped. We have a Scholars Under Fire database. It's attempts to sanction mostly faculty, but it could also be like postdoc researchers, things like that. And we have a student database that tracks attempts to get individual students and student groups sanctioned. And in all of these, we've seen basically the first two, the deplatforming and Scholars Under Fire database, they go back to about 2000, so they span over 25 years. Up until this year, we basically had tracked very few attempts by the, quote, government to actually sanction campus speech. I think it summed up to maybe 100 over the 25-year period. And we're well above that this year, and so we're kind of very concerned about that as well.
All right, we're talking with Sean Stevens from FIRE for just a few more minutes. All right, now Sean, again, college students, this is the famous or infamous Gen Z. Now, for we older types, maybe slightly much more older types, we look at the kids, we're like, what on earth? Where did this come from? So, an open-ended question. Where are these kids getting these ideas? 91% say words can be violence. Where, I mean, very open-ended, more opinionated, if you will.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
I'll get a little speculative here, but, you know, with my background in psychology, I'll say there's multiple reasons, right? It's multiply determined. A lot of it, I think, comes from, like I mentioned before, our media environment with social media and the explosion of the internet and the use of this as a main source of not just news but interaction. I think we're now finally, you know, about 10 years ago, when I was working at Heterodox Academy with Jonathan Haidt, him and I put out this hypothesis that the younger generation is more censorious. But the you know, back then we were like, all right, the jury's still out because we don't have enough data. Last year, Greg and I basically reviewed that and kind of came to the conclusion that the hypothesis holds water, and it does seem like this generation is more censorious than ones in the past. I think a lot of that comes from being a lot of their socialization in their formative years happening on social media. You had the COVID pandemic and lockdowns and reduced social interaction there, I don't think helped. But I also think some of this maybe even goes further back. There's parenting styles, as Greg and John talked about in their book, Coddling the American Mind. There was the introduction of kind of anti-bullying programs, which, you know, hey, good programs, well-intentioned, but I think a lot of the ideas of words can be violence come from things like that. And so it's well-intentioned in wanting to prevent bullying at first, but you inevitably get what psychologists call concept creep, and the definition expands to include more and more things. And things that maybe don't really rise. As you, one of you mentioned earlier, it's like, well, being punched in the face is a lot different than being called a nasty word. As someone who's played ice hockey for 38 years, I very much agree with that. But I think a lot of this comes from studies are definitely well-intentioned ideas that then have gone too far.
All right, Sean, before we let you go, let me toss in an extra element, and if I'm wrong, feel free to shoot this down, all right?
Sure.
All those things you just mentioned, all right, young people, I mean, we've interviewed Penn State students a lot over the last couple of years here on our show about politics and other various things. Very smart young people that we've dealt with, at least. They've been great. Mm-hmm. But these are college kids. Is it possible that over a number of years they've been led in a certain direction by adults with certain leanings, or is that just not happening?
Oh, no, yeah, I think that there is, that's kind of the point of Greg and John's book, Coddling of the American Mind, is I think a lot of this actually starts before college, and they've kind of been led to these ideas through K-12 education, and then also how parenting styles and kind of this very protective, remove all obstacles, remove all potential from harm philosophy, it kind of prevents people from growing, right? Like, to grow, I think you need to be challenged. You need to have some difficult experiences. And we, for a while, it seems like we, our parenting styles, not all of us, but a lot of people in our culture and society, it shifted to this, no, there just can't be any harm. There can't be any bad things. Like, we're going to create this very curated environment where nobody gets offended. And I don't think that's good for growth. And I think that's been a disservice to this generation.
All right, Sean, we got maybe a minute. What's a solution to any of this? Or is there no solution? We're just doomed to keep going down this road.
I think there's some encouraging signs maybe in the aftermath of the assassination, like I said, in the data. I think students, you know, that almost half of them said none of the above to any of the options that we selected for violence, which I thought were pretty encompassing, means it's like, wait, maybe you weren't necessarily thinking this through so much at first, and then now that there's this very salient event and you have an example of it, it's like, wait, no, we did not mean that that was okay. And I think that that is at least somewhat encouraging, although there are, like I said, there's other troubling signs that existing ideological divisions are going to remain and maybe strengthen, you know, get harder.
Sean, real quick, you folks have a website, very informative website.
Yep.
What is that again?
So for years it was thefire.org, but now fire.org will also get you there. We've got, basically you could access all our research from there. You could access any other information about fire as well. And then we also have we have another website for our college free speech rankings. That's rankings.thefire.org. And you can explore all of our college data there.
Well, Sean, we appreciate your time this morning again. I'm on your list. Keep sending out the information, interesting and otherwise.
Yep.
And I don't know, go Eagles or something, all right? So have a good day.
Oh,
you too. Thanks for having me again.